This week's episode of the FitCast is brought to you by TurbulenceTraining.com, BlackStarLabs.com, and by StrengthCoach.com. Well, welcome to this week's episode of the FitCast. This is FitCast episode number 127 for March 15th, 2009. I'm Kevin Larrabee, and we got the cast with us this week. First, we have Jonathan Fass of AcceleratedStrength.com and the never-updated blog at jonathanfass.blogspot.com. What's up, John?
No, maybe once to twice monthly updated blog.
All right, well, you're behind schedule. Then we got Tony Jellicore. Tony Jellicore of the Boston Herald Step Up blog and Jellicoretraining.com, and he has made his return to the T-Nation front page.
Oh, yeah. That was very exciting. But hi, guys. What's going on?
Nothing.
No awkwardness. No awkwardness whatsoever there.
Oh, and last but not least, we have the return of Lee Peel, who is a little under the weather, but you can check out her websites at avidityfitness.net and the brand new flzine.com. What's up, Lee?
Not much. Thank you for the disclaimer.
No problem. It's another episode of the FitCast, and we're going to start with the mention that towards the end of the show, Mike Boyle and I did an interview, and that will be coming up at the, like I said, towards the end of the show. We talked about quite a bit of stuff there, and if you know Mike Boyle, he tends to go off on tangents, so we did plenty of that. And just, you know what to expect when it comes from Mike Boyle. It's just pretty much all gold in there, so make sure to stick around for that. Next, Mike Robertson has a new podcast called In the Trenches Fitness, and I got to be on episode zero, so I don't even get a number.
I noticed that, actually.
I'm just non-existent, which, Mike, that was cool. Anyways, episode zero, I guess, is up at robertsontrainingsystems.com, and I'll link to it. And he's sending out links for that in his newsletter as well. And Mike has gone off, and he's doing a weekly podcast where he's doing lots of mailbag type stuff, and he's going to be interviewing someone at the end of each episode. And I'm sorry for what you guys are hearing in the background. I forgot to turn off my Skype sounds. But I was on it this past week, and Lee is going to be on it this week. So make sure to check that out. Lee, have you done your interview with Mike yet?
No, I haven't. I do it Wednesday, and I listened to the podcast, and I thought he did a great job. And
I did too.
Really,
yeah, he did a really good job.
Yeah, he definitely. I mean, for his first go around, it sounded great.
Mm-hmm. He's just so genuine, and it comes across. It just really comes across in what he does. So I'm looking forward to seeing where he takes it, and I'm very honored to be one of the first people that he interviews.
Yes, but you weren't on episode zero. You get to be episode one.
I saw
one.
That, and I was like, zero.
Yeah. Kevin's agent zero.
Like, the worst part is, like, just to let you guys know, this episode's probably gonna suck.
Yeah.
Like, what?
So here's Kevin Larrabee.
And it's all right. I love Mike, so it's no problem. Speaking of interviews, Dave Tate's going to be coming back on the show. So if you do have questions for Dave Tate, probably the strongest person I ever met. You can make sure to send in those questions to questions@thefitcast.com, or you can just send them in through there. It's probably going to be the best way to get them in, and we'll probably be doing that either this upcoming week or the week after that. So we haven't had him on since episode like 50, I think. So it's been about 70 episodes since we had him on. So make sure to take advantage of Dave. He is quite the busy man over there at Elite FTS, and if you do have any questions, this is going to be the time to ask him. Next, I put up the FitCast Insider. It's back up until April 1st for $59. So if you want to check that out, it's just the FitCastInsider.com. There's about 20 interviews in there, including a couple that I did with Tony, and also there's a high-quality version of the Dan John squat video that you can download on there, and it's pretty easy to burn that to a DVD if you want to keep that for your home library. Perform Better is coming up. It's coming to Boston in March from the 21st to the 22nd at the Reggie Lewis Center. Who's going?
I'm going to try my best to get there on one of the days. I know we've had to extend our hours at CP on the weekend, so I'm going to try to get in there on Saturday. We'll see. I love going to their day seminars. They're awesome.
We had a good time last year, I think. Oh, no, two years ago.
Yeah.
I didn't go
last year. You didn't go last year, right?
Yeah, I was sick.
I tend to just stay for the actual lectures. The hands-on, I tend to take off after that, but they do a really good job with that.
Did you get a cheesesteak last year, too?
A what?
Did you go to that cheesesteak place again?
Cheesesteak place? Oh, yeah. No. We didn't do that last year. No. I remember. I forgot about that.
John, you're staying in the New Jersey area, right?
Yeah, probably. I've got boards to take pretty soon, so I'll be laying low for a while.
Actually, that reminds me of something. Lee, you're not going, right?
I might. It's up in the air. It's a maybe.
Okay. Well, if Tony and Lee, if you guys know out a date, I'll try to go on the same day so we can at least like get someone to eat or something. I'll take you out to lunch. Repay you for your hours of time having to answer questions that I ask you. The next thing is, Lee, what's going on at flzine.com? What's new?
A lot's new. Basically, I'm still kind of getting into the swing of things and getting things like kind of together. The interview with John Fass is coming up this week.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And there's also a special feature on Tony Gentilcore via Mike Howard.
That's right.
Yeah, and it's going to be really good. So that and some cartoons and likely some more, a lot of making fun of people saying stupid things, because that's what we like to do there too. And it's just going to be a lot of fun. I'm still getting in the swing there, but it's starting to kind of calm down, and I'm getting a backlog of things to do, so I'm not like crazy every week. It's good.
Very cool. People can check that out again. It's just flzine.com. And last but not least, we should probably talk about Lee and I think we've agreed to call this Destination Abs now.
Yes.
Okay. Mm. So as we speak, this is the last day of week 3, and I'm still doing very well. I get to do refeeds on Monday and Tuesday, which is pretty cool. And we're getting tons of requests to talk about this in a lot more detail. So I think Lee and I might talk about this some week.
Yeah, I think we should. I think we should, because people want to know why I'm torturing you the way I am. I've gotten like a bunch of emails, and they're like, "Oh my god, how could you make him eat that little?" I'm like, "There is rhyme or reason, I swear."
Yeah, so we'll talk about that, and I'll be posting pictures either tomorrow night or Tuesday morning that will be taken before the refeeds, and it's very weird. I'm finding it. It's not necessarily hard to find foods for those refeeds, but. I'm always trying to lean towards healthier stuff for the refeeds, and I'm going to be going shopping, going to the grocery store after this show. And you can see my mind's starting to get very foggy towards this third week. I've noticed that a little bit, but...
And going shopping when you're hungry is risky.
No, I'm not hungry right now.
Yeah, it's bad.
I'm on my second seltzer water in the last 60 minutes, so those keep me going. But we'll talk a little bit more about that in the near future. So that's it for the FitCast related stuff. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with the responses from the question of the week from last week. If you want to boost muscle growth and blowtorch body fat, head over to turbulencetraining.com and also check out ttmembers.com, a monthly Turbulence Training website where you can get a new program every single month. So the question we had for the audience last week was whether or not they weigh their food, and really this came I was just curious, you know, how anal are people about weighing their food, and a lot of this stuff actually stems, or a lot of the answers stem from what Lee Peel did a couple months ago now, but the first response we got was from Manny. He said, "Hey guys, great episode this week as usual. Response to the question of the week, no, I do not weigh my food, although as part of my dietetic internship, I have weighed other people's food before and after eating, oh my god, and to the nearest tenth of a gram. During a rotation at the Irving Institute of Clinical Research, if you thought Lee Peel was anal, try doing a research study that involves calorie counting. The show also made me wonder how many people actually understand what John meant when he said PO before Cast explained it. I'm doing clinical rotations now, and abbreviations like this one have been so ingrained in my head that I don't think anything of John's use of the term until Kevin gave the, quote, nerd alert. I realize the FitCast listeners come from many different backgrounds, and some have an extensive clinical background, while others probably have no clue what the heck John was talking about. It would be interesting to see how other listeners felt about this. Keep up the great work as always." And again, that's from Manny. The next one was from Amanda. "Yes, I weigh my food with a digital scale. Lee's video on how easy it is to mismeasure food was all the incentive I needed." And Lee, do you want to talk a little bit about what you did in that video a couple months ago?
I put it out like a year ago.
Oh, a year ago.
And that video has been highly responsible for a lot of, I guess, like traffic or networking or whatever, because who knew that like me measuring peanut butter and nutmeg on the scale would have like been like such a thing. But, you know, I did it because there were so many people that would just keep saying, "Oh, you know I'm hitting 1700 calories a day. Oh, I know I'm hitting 2000 calories a day and I'm still not losing." And these would, you know, be my clients or people that I just like, you know, helped online or whatever. And I'm like, "Well, have you weighed it?" And they're like, "Well, no, I don't need to. I use cups or I use this." And so I was kind of doing it to show people that even if you're using cups or even if you think that you're taking things to the precaution level that you are, that you can still be really off in your caloric intake. And the problem usually comes with this is people, they have this shot of calories that they want to hit, you know, that they're like, "Oh, well, I'm going to hit 1500 calories today." And so they go for that, and usually they have this kind of little nibble here, this little bite there that they do, and, you know, it leads them to, in their mind, they're already over a little bit, you know, usually 15 equals 16 or 1650. And that's okay if it actually is that, and you're moving enough and burning enough for that to create a deficit. But if you think that you're hitting something and then in actuality you're actually hitting, you know, 18, 19, even 2,000, it can lead to you feeling really frustrated and beating yourself up for something that isn't even necessarily your fault. You may have the actual dedication and a desire to want to hit the kind of caloric intake to hit your goals that you want to, but you miss it because of a technicality. And so people want to look at me and they're like, "Oh God, like, don't you want to live? How can you be so anal?" And it's like, look, I don't want to be the person who's losing fat for 10 years. That's, you know, I don't, and I've seen those people, you know, I don't want to be the person that messes up because of a technicality. And if you're in maintenance and if you're just lifting to, you know, gain some muscle or you're, you know, you're just doing a little bit of body recomp, it's not even that necessary to be that particular. But if you work in an office all day, you're not very active, and every little calorie counts, then I say take it to the scale, weigh it out, get in and get it done. And then after you're done with your fat loss and after you've achieved your goals that you've wanted to achieve, then, yeah, you know, like learn how to just live and eat and try and listen to your body some. But I just think it's important to at least have a few days of weighing what you do and seeing what you do, because cereal, for example, because a lot of, you know, people eat cereal, is really deceptive. And you know, a lot of people will you know, get a bowl of cereal thinking it's 200 calories, and then they weigh it on the scale and they realize that it's like 450, easy. So I just think it's important to have a moment where you're real with yourself, and then how much you need to keep doing that is based upon your results. If you're getting it without it, yay. But if you're not getting it, then it may be something you need to use. So that's how it kind of all came about, and that's what it's trying to really show in the video.
We'll make sure to link to the video as well in the show notes if people didn't check that out beforehand. The last response was from Weldon. In regards to weighing my food, yes, I weigh everything when I'm home. For nuts, I have saved various size scoops from powdered products and found which ones correspond to a serving for each kind, so I don't have to weigh my daily rations of almonds, pecans, Brazil nuts. So do you think he should still be weighing it, although he's kind of have a set system with a measuring scoop?
I mean, if it's working, you know, some people don't have to. If it's working for him and he's getting the results that he wants to get, then yay. You know, but if not, then that might be the first area you go. You know, that's your little troubleshoot area. And that's where you can kind of hone in.
Very good. Well, we will talk more about that. Do any of you guys have a question for this week's question of the week?
You caught us off guard there, Kevin.
I did, because, you know, I like to, if it's like a spur of the moment kind of thing, it makes a little bit less sense to do. I know.
You know what I would like to know?
I'd like to know
how many of the listeners are actually stretching and when they do it. I talk a lot about it and I never see it.
And how long? Gyms.
Yeah.
We can even add an adjunct to that, how many are actually foam rolling. And doing their actual warm up.
Should we just, you know, make this easy and just say foam rolling / stretching?
Sure.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Okay.
Fair.
Done. That's the question of the week. We need a question of the week music too. I'll remember to find that. All right, we'll be right back. We got quite an extensive mailbag, so stick around. If you want to get the best tasting, highest quality protein powder out there, you gotta go to blackstarlabs.com. Now with new discounted prices, so you can save more than ever. Welcome to the mailbag. This week we have our first question that, remember we had a couple questions about stance, John?
Yeah,
remember that?
I do.
That was from Kazim, and I hope I say that correctly, from China. Mm-hmm. Hello, FitCast crew. Thank you for the fascinating answer to my previous questions a few months ago about stance training. I was truly honored to receive the joint pink dumbbell award for that episode. I've got two more questions that I hope you could answer. Number one, when I do bodyweight squats, my legs reach about parallel with the floor at the bottom of the movement. When I do front squats with a moderate weight, 8 to 10 reps, I can go down into a full squat. But when I try single leg squats, I find it quite hard to even get down past 45 degrees. This seems to be a big limitation factor in my ability to go into low kung fu drop stance, which places the vast majority of your weight on one leg. Do you have any tips for improving this? I already do other single leg exercises like lunges and Bulgarian split squats, and don't have any major problems with those. So, John, do you want to address that first one?
Yeah. It could be a number of things. Sometimes what happens is we look at the stiffness of the body. This, if you kind of think of what people used to say about bodybuilding, where it's like, oh, he's muscle-bound and therefore he's not flexible. Flexibility is different from muscle stiffness. So if you're looking at a person with a lot of muscle, they're going to be and I think we may have talked about this a couple episodes ago, but they're going to be a little bit stiffer. It doesn't mean that the range of motion of the joint is any different, but it means that you're going to have to put more force in to actually get that full range. So it's possible if he's, you know, developed a lot of the hip muscle and the leg muscle, which you would assume in stance training, that when he goes into a front squat with weight, he'll have enough stiffness in the body to drop all the way down. But when he doesn't have that weight, he won't be able to move fully in range. The other part, though, is when he's talking about a single leg stance, it's possible there's just muscle weakness there and he's not moving properly. One way that you can figure that out is normally you'll have an asymmetry. So it's not that, you know, your left and right glute may be weak, but it may be that one is weaker than the other. So if you try a single leg right on your right foot and then a single leg squat on your left foot, if you find that there's a difference in the movement, then that may show you that there's something going on, that you're moving differently on one side versus the other. So I would suggest to look at both of those things. But if he's able to get a full range squat and it's a good squat with weight, it may just mean that he needs to that he's going to have difficulty doing that unweighted because of just the inherent stiffness of the muscles in the body. And that's more, you know, maybe you could say soft tissue and foam rolling, but there is a point where it's just the nature of included muscle bulk.
John, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
You know how Boyle always talks about the lateral subsystem, you mm-hmm. know, with single leg movements and how, you know, like a two-legged squat, I always like to tell people a two-legged squat is completely different than a one-legged squat.
Right.
And, you know, as engaging the lateral subsystem, like my opinion is, you know, we need to practice the actual one-legged squat. So, mm-hmm. You know, my suggestion would be, I mean, certainly I don't want them to dive bomb it, but if we have to start with like at the bench or a low box, I usually tell people I want to control as much as possible on the way down to right. like we're sitting on broken glass. And then if they have to come over 2 feet, that's fine. I just yeah. really want them to control that eccentric. So would that be something that we would try to advocate? You know, if he wants to get better at one-legged squat, well, we need to practice our one-legged squats.
I would definitely agree with them. That's the way that I do that also. I go from different levels and have them control it the way down and then stand up on the way up. It depends really on what's going on there, though. Like I said, if it's just muscle stiffness, we did that at Bill's actually. He videotaped that for the Indianapolis strength seminar. And I think if you get that DVD, he talks a lot about that, about the idea of, you know, it's the reason why like powerlifters will wear squat suits and things, because it increases the inherent stiffness of the body. So when you're loaded up with tons of weight, that stiffness can be used. But if you don't have any weight on your body, it's just too much stiffness and you won't be able to move at all. So it does depend. If it's a strength issue, absolutely agree with you. If it's an issue of just that there's too much stiffness going on in the hips, per se, stretching might help that a little bit, and foam rolling might help that a little bit, but he may also just have more difficulty getting down there. But when he's actually applying force, that's an advantage. So it's an adaptive advantage. And if you stretch too much and you do too much soft tissue work, you may actually decrease your advantage, because it's something that the body has developed to make you better at the functional movement that you're doing.
What about for people, can they use things like just wrapping something like a super band around a power rack or something like that and just using that as some counter resistance?
Yeah, I mean, you can do that, and it would be to push you into the squat in this situation. So, yeah, you could definitely do that, but then again, then you might as well just have a bar or something too. I mean, it just depends on what the position is. In Kung Fu training and stance training, you're not going to really be able to do that. It's just a matter of trying to get to the position. I mean, he may, you know, at least for the two-leg squat, he was saying he really can't get as low as when he's actually loaded on a front squat. I mean, he could try to change the distance of the feet and increase the width of the feet. For the single-leg squat, I do suspect that it has more to do with muscle activity, because mm-hmm. if he can get down, let's say, parallel with two legs, then increasing the weight on one leg should be able to, you know, allow him to drop a little bit further. So in that situation, I think it's probably muscle activity more than anything else. So he may be avoiding a position. And it's easy to fake a squat, especially a front squat. You can go very heavy on the quads and almost entirely avoid the glutes and the posterior chain if you do it, you know, somewhat incorrectly. So I would look in that direction first as far as what's going on there with the single leg squat. He may just be completely using the quads, and in that case he's not going to be able to go any further, because the pressure on the knee is going to stop him from going any further.
The second question that he had was in regards to grip strength. Do you have any ideas on for improving finger strength? Think gripping, clawing, or jabbing with the tips of your fingers. Most grip exercises I have heard of seem to work the gripping muscles in the forearms as opposed to the fingers themselves. And I know you have some experience with this, Sean. Do you have any ideas?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we used to literally do fingertip push-ups. And that's the kind of stuff you'd see like Bruce Lee doing, and he does like two-finger push-ups and stuff. I don't know of much that is better than the old style of training in that sense. You would also do things where you would start with diving your hand into sand, and then you'd slowly but surely increase that to like gravel, pebbles, and then rocks. So these are the ways that the old style used to, the masters back in the days used to do it. And that's still probably a good way to increase that type of strength. It's probably not good for your joints so much, but if that's what you're doing and that's your practice, then that's probably along the lines of what you'll have to do is like fingertip push-ups.
The next question comes from Matt. I hope this is where I send the mailbag. Okay, I shouldn't have read that. The show is great. Keep it up, Kevin. You need more nerd tweets. I guess that he means talking about Twitter. My question is about Red Bull. I love sugar-free Red Bull. I actually own poweredbyredbull.com. I like it. Like Kevin likes spike shooters. What are your thoughts on sugar-free Red Bull? Is it terrible for me? I love Red Bull. Thanks, Matt.
P.S. I like Red Bull.
So, Lee, is sugar-free Red Bull okay?
Yeah, he likes it. Go have for it. It's whatever.
It tastes like ass, though, compared to
I don't personally like the way it tastes or anything, and I don't drink Spike, I don't drink Red Bulls, I don't drink Rockstar, I don't drink anything like that. So to me, it's so not in my tasting league. But as far as is it going to do anything for you? I mean, it's all the same stuff. I mean, it's all the same thing. It's just going to hype you up. So I personally have a weird kind of difference between, do I want my hype coming from caffeine or do I want it coming from sugar? I mean, I just think it depends. I mean, if you can't have the sugar and you can't use it for anything, then go for the sugar-free caffeine and let it do something for you. That's about it. I mean, it's not going to kill you, or at least not that I'm aware of. I haven't seen any research that says Red Bull is going to kill you. And until I see so, I'm just going to go with, how about it?
Isn't Rockstar the most pompous name for a drink ever?
I just see it, and I see, like, Tommy Lee and Joe.
No, it's like, losers that I'm not saying you're a loser if you drink it, but, like, the dudes that I see bringing into the gym are the same dudes that bring in, like, pre-made shakes that they picked up from the GNC refrigerator before they hit the gym.
I just see tattoo porn.
Yeah, pretty much. No, you're right.
I mean, it's just what I look at that can and I see tattooed porn, and I'm just like, that's just all that's me there.
Keep that in mind, folks.
Also, just a word of warning. I just want to throw in a word of warning. Don't mix it with vodka.
Oh yeah, right.
What,
yeah.
Rockstar?
No, Red Bull or
Red Bull one.
Yeah.
I thought people do that all the time.
Yeah, think, you know what? I learned the hard way a couple of years ago, and I'm just trying to pass on
trying to look out for some people.
Yeah,
right?
I'm trying to look out.
Next birthday, though, I will try Spike and vodka. I'm sure that would taste pretty good.
Actually, I knew a guy that did Jaeger and Spike. And
wow.
Not so much?
Yeah. Apparently, that was a fun combination.
I lived life dangerously once and mixed a protein shake with Spike.
Yeah, that was stupid, Tony. You almost spit it up all over the floor, too.
That didn't taste good at all.
All right, next question comes from Shannon. I've tried fish oil in the past and always get the afterburb effect. Now, there is a lot of hype over the quality of fish oil, and I was wondering what a good brand and a good price to pay for quality fish oil would be. All any of the podcasts I listen to ever say is don't cheap out on the fish oil. I agree, but they never give a brand recommendation. So what brands of fish oil do you guys take and where can I get it online? What are some things I should look for when selecting a brand of fish oil? Thanks, Shannon. Lee, go for it.
I actually think that you can cheap out on fish oil. And there does seem to be a small distinction between certain brands. There's a website called, forgive me, consumerlabs.com.
Yeah, Consumer Reports.
It's
Consumer Labs, too.
It's Consumer. There's actual, they actually go over supplements, and they go through like exactly what like each supplement has put in it and things like that. You have to be a member to get the certain things. So it depends on how deeply you're into using supplements and what kind of information you really want to know about the supplements you're taking. But they go through a bunch. They go through Twin Labs, they go through Carlson's, they go through a bunch of different kind of brands and labels, and they kind of dissect them, if you will, and talk about what kind of factory usage they have or what kind of ingredients they use, things like that. So when it comes to fish oil, you know, what you really don't want to have is a spoiling, if you will. You know, it's an oil, it can go rancid, and there is some research that can lead to saying that, you know, as it gets older, it can be less effective. So if that is a concern for you, then you'd want to stay away from anything that was bottled and not stored properly. And I usually find that in transport, companies are a little bit lacking of keeping the environment they need to keep for liquid. Although liquid does seem to be good, there is also people that say it can hit the air and things can happen with oxidation there. So I don't know. I go with the capsules and I go with Costco. It's really cheap. You can get a bunch at one time. It has the perfect, it has everything you need and you can get a bunch. So, as there are some other people that like other brands, there's Carlson's, there's, Kirkland's, there's, Udo's different kinds of oil. Actually, I don't even know if they do fish. I think they just do flax. But there's all kinds of brands. I personally go with the highest gram dosage in a capsule because I don't like taking a lot of capsules. So look for the highest, to keep it really simple, the more calories each capsule has, usually like the better concentration per capsule. So that's what you're looking for, is concentration of EPA and DHA and you can go cheap, and I like Costco's, and it's really cheap and easy to get. You can get big and bulk there. And I think you can also get some on trueprotein.com that's really cheap. And if you want to look more into supplements in general and fish oil quality, you can go to consumerlabs.com.
Tony and John, what do you use for fish oil?
I use Flame Out. I get my the biotester every month, so I use Flame Out. But in the past, I have used Carlson's, and I remember way back in the day I used to go to Walmart, but that stuff's just bad. So but no, I typically use Flame Out.
Yeah, I'm with Lee. I actually just use Costco.
Well, huge thing about Costco brand is that the if you have a Costco membership, you can actually get it online now. It's actually $3 off this week. So you can get 400 soft gels for $7, folks.
And I know, and when I hung out with Cass last summer, I think when I went out for her wedding, her and I were talking about pharmaceutical grade fish oil, and she's all about pharmaceutical grade.
Yeah.
So, and I think she mentioned some websites that you could get for that. She's all about pharmaceutical grade. She's very adamant on people getting that. But as far as where to find it, I have no idea, but I just know that she's a very big fan of that kind.
Yeah,
of
but a lot of people just want to get the benefits and spend as little as possible.
I understand.
Yeah. Mike Russell, I think, also he talks about 50% EPA DHA pills also, and I've yet to really find one, but they're out there. So
very interesting. So head to Costco. Actually, I might go today. The next question comes from Charlie. I'm about to have shoulder surgery, labrum repair, and subacromial decompression at the end of April. Rehab on the shoulder is looking at 3 to 5 months. Any suggestions on exercises I can do while my shoulder is out of commission? I recently made big strides in strength, but need to get body fat down. I'm thinking this is a good time to stop worrying about adding strength and mass and just worry about leaning up. Also, any thoughts of pre-surgery exercise to either help the rehab out? Thanks, guys. Love the podcast, Charlie. John, what do you have for Charlie?
It's funny about these questions, and people write in and say, you know, I'm about to have surgery. What can I do afterwards? And I think something that I've failed to mention too is just the fact that after surgery, you're not doing much of anything. It hurts like hell. You know, so it's not something to overlook the fact that you're going to be out of commission for a while, whether you like it or not. Some people will respond differently, and some, you know, surgeries can run the gamut as far as some people popping right up out of bed afterwards and other people just feeling like they just got hit by a Mack truck. But for a while, chances are you're not going to be doing much of anything, and that's where the acute stage rehab takes place. Afterwards, it's going to depend on your therapist and your orthopedist and what type of things you're able to do. In situations like that, those are actually where the use of machines might come into play a little bit more, something like a leg press, for instance, versus a squat, because you're just not going to be able to get your arm in position, and it's not a good idea to do that either. So you do have to respect the healing process. You may be able to do some things, maybe some lower body exercise, assuming that there's not too much pressure, but there are a lot of things that go into a surgery, and you're better off just listening to the advice of the physical therapist than trying necessarily to do some things on your own. But you may also, like single leg work or something like that. Beforehand, I mean, it really depends on what happened with your labrum. Was it, an acute damage, or was this over time a fraying of the labrum? For the most part, I would probably say to look at your shoulder positioning, so that type of work, and to avoid anything that's going to hurt you. You're going to have some movements and positions, and depending how badly the damage is, you may be able to have a decent range of motion right now or almost nothing at all. So I couldn't tell you exactly what you're able to do, but in general, posterior chain, posterior chain, posterior chain. That's what I would look at. But really seek the advice of someone that can look at you and to tell you where, potentially the problem is coming from or the secondary problems, and to look at those things first.
Lee, how much does someone, going into surgery and then after that, looking at a couple months off from training, how much do they have to really change their nutrition?
Well, it depends.
Sorry, I gave you kind of a loaded question.
No. It kind of depends on what you are having done. Of course, but after surgery, the most key element is healing, and what promotes the most healing is a really good protein intake. So you like to keep fats, you like to keep proteins really solid around a recovery period. You don't necessarily have to be in a caloric surplus. Like you don't have to have an excess of calories per se. But in most things, you're going to find that being hypercaloric is not the best thing to do. So, I usually like to tell people if they're recovering from a surgery that, make sure to up your protein. You want to have, do I have necessarily 100% information to back the gram ratio? No, but I usually suggest for people to go like 1.4 times body weight in protein, just to make sure, you're just kind of just taking that extra precaution, and make sure to keep their fats really good. This is the time to, really focus on veggies and fruits. And so if I was going into surgery and coming out of it, whereas I usually have a little bit more kind of lackadaisical attitude about my diet, I might have some things here or there that most might consider, dirty. I'll keep it really clean. I'll keep really just make sure that I'm getting my bang for my buck and make sure everything's dialed in, because I don't want to spend extra time recovering. And nutrition can play a really big role in that. So that's kind of where I take it.
Nilo has the final questions. Hey, guys, I have two questions about something that I think everyone experiences, but they don't think much of it. It would be great to get your opinions. Number one, what causes delayed onset muscle soreness? I believe that the common misconception is that it is due to lactic acid, but that is a myth, right? Lactic acid is flushed out pretty quickly. I understand that this is due to micro tears and breakdown in the muscle fibers. If this is true, wouldn't it make more sense for me to be more sore an hour or two after I lift rather than 2 to 3 days later? I swear if I do something that I haven't done in a while, even like snowboarding, for example, sometimes I am most sore like 3 days after. Why? My second question kind of depends on your answer to the first question, but from my understanding, DOMS is basically a side effect of the muscle repairing itself, which is essentially how you build muscle. However, if this is true, then why do we try to minimize muscle breakdown by things like ice baths and anti-inflammatories? Aren't we just preventing what we are ultimately trying to achieve? Thanks, guys. I look forward to hearing your answers. And I think we've talked about this on the show a couple times, but we'll bring it up one more time. Tony, you want to talk about DOMS a little bit?
Yeah, delayed onset muscle soreness. Yeah, it is a very big misconception that it is due to lactic acid. That was kind of debunked a few years ago in a couple of studies. But, you know, it is one of those misnomers that we don't know to the full extent of what causes delayed onset muscle soreness. But our best guess is that it is due to the micro tears of the body, of the muscles breaking down. And, you know, the reason why your muscles get sore after not doing something for a while is, you know, because you haven't done it for a while. You're not using muscles. You're using muscles that you haven't been using for a while. Like a good example at which we brought up in the off topic is the last few weeks we've been doing stadium sprints at the stairs over at Harvard Stadium. And my calves are killing me the next one or two days afterward, like killing me. Like they are absolutely on fire. And I can't remember the last time I did stairs. And the reason why my calves hurt is because, you know, I haven't used them to that capacity. So anytime you pass a threshold that the body isn't used to, its response is going to, you know, stuff's going to be sore for a couple of days. But, you know, I could be mistaken, but I'm pretty sure like the delayed onset muscle soreness is, it's just one of those misnomers that we have. We don't know entirely what causes it, but it is due to the micro tears. And maybe Lee or John can elaborate a little bit further. But that would be my take on it.
You want to go, Lee, or should I grab something?
I mean, I'm right there with Tony. You know, you damage the muscles. It causes an inflammation, and you're going to respond to that. As far as the kind of should we stop the anti-inflammatories, I guess I'll hit on that a little bit, and then John will bring it all together. You know, the anti-inflammatories around workout, it's kind of a, you know, the thing is like, yes, you want a certain amount of inflammation. You do want a certain amount of inflammation, and you're going to break things down. But what not necessarily is known, or at least, and maybe John might know this, but is the length of time in which that you need that inflammation. How important is that length of time? To my understanding, we're not completely aware of that. There is something to be said about timing your antioxidants and timing your anti-inflammatories a little bit after your workout, just to make sure that you've gotten some inflammation and some kind of response in, but not completely stopping it immediately. So I've always kind of lived by the notion of if you're taking any vitamin C or any sort of, like, you know, you're really dosing on some fish oil, especially if you're having any sort of injury or arthritic kind of conditions going on, that you wait around 30 minutes to an hour or so to interject that into your body and allow for a little bit of inflammation to occur, but then to, you know, keep it from being overly inflamed or having any sort of problems. And that can kind of help with DOMS. And there's been a lot of anecdotal looks at that. So I'm curious to see what John has to say, but that's kind of from my knowledge and my reading of what I know of what you would want to do timing wise around your workout as far as anti-inflammatories or antioxidants.
Well, okay. I hope everyone is sitting down right now. Because lactic acid is not produced in the human body.
Oh.
Not unless you have – if you're diabetic or you have, you know, kidney or liver disease, and there's certain drug side effects also that might cause the body to produce lactic acid. But otherwise, lactic acid is not produced in the human body. So the problem occurs between lactic acid and lactate, and those are two separate entities, but they – kind of sound the same, and people, and including research scientists, I mean, everybody uses them interchangeably, and they're not the same thing. And I think this is where a lot of the problem comes in when people discuss what happens with, you know, like a burn from exercise. Lactic acid was proposed almost 90 years ago, but the problem was there was never actually conclusive experimental research showing a cause and effect. So there were some theoretical diagrams and things like that, but no one ever really proved that lactic acid was the cause of muscle burn, but it just started – that was the proposed theory and everyone ran with it. 2004 was where Roberg's really suggested that lactic acid doesn't occur in the body, and that that's not the cause of muscle burn. So what actually occurs is that I'm going to assume everyone's heard of ATP. That's the main source of energy in the body over, you know, the first responsive energy. When ATP is broken, it's ATP, it becomes ADP, adenosine triphosphate to diphosphate. And from that breaking of the chemical bonds, you release energy. Diphosphate and an inorganic phosphate and then a hydrogen are released in that process. That hydrogen is what causes acidification of the blood tissue. So you release a hydrogen and now you've got, you know, an acid floating around, free floating in the system. The body responds to that part of the energy systems. Then you get into like glycolysis and things like that. One of the byproducts of glycolysis is something called pyruvate. And pyruvate will take up two protons. It'll take up two hydrogens. So it's the body's way of buffering, taking, removing acid from the system. The pyruvate plus two hydrogens equals lactate. So we do see lactate in the blood, but lactate is a good thing. And that's further broken down to produce more energy. So there is a correlation. When you have a lot of lactate in the blood, that means that there was a lot of acid, but the lactate didn't cause it. So it actually responded to it and made your body better, more capable of doing more high-intensity exercise. So let's just debunk that myth right there. So when you have that initial burn from exercise, it just has to do with protons released from ATP. It has nothing whatsoever to do with lactic acid. As far as DOMS is concerned, it has nothing to do with that initial burn. And people sort of think, well, it must because it kind of feels the same. And when I move, it feels the same. I get this burn, so they must be related. They have almost nothing to do with one another. What Tony and Lee were saying is correct. You have breakdown of sarcomere, so muscle tissue itself, and that breakdown will cause prostaglandin response. So you have an inflammatory response to tissue damage. And that inflammation will excite free nerve endings, and that where they think that most of the DOMS comes into play is from inflammation and swelling, as far as and also the mechanical damage, which can also release free radicals, which will also excite nerve endings. So that's the reason why you would want to reduce inflammation. But at the same time, inflammation is the body's natural response to damage. It brings blood and nutrient to the system. So it's kind of – you bring down the inflammation because you don't want to be in pain, but it's also something that you want to encourage as far as blood flow. Inflammation, though, is a swelling of interstitial tissue, so you want to improve blood flow. So as far as how do you deal with DOMS – they've looked at a whole bunch of different ways to do it. One of the best ways seems to be the active recovery. So you have when you mix protocols, when you have like a warm-up plus stretching plus like post-exercise massage plus active recovery, those seem to get the best results. Anything individually, though, doesn't do all of it because chances are it's not just one thing causing DOMS. It's a whole bunch of things. So you need to attack it through a bunch of different methods. They've had good research with cryotherapy, so like kind of ice baths or ice cuffs and compression. But the problem with those studies is they usually take one muscle, so they'll do eccentric work on the biceps. Our workouts don't really work that way, so it's limited in how you can actually apply that. So the best way to deal with it, like I said before, get into the gym the day after, do some light aerobics or light activity, try to move as much as you possibly can, try to encourage blood flow, and you can take NSAIDs. There's some limited research showing that those are positive. You can adjust dietary intake as well, but those things probably have more to do with like athletes that are actually competing, where DOMS might affect their activity and their performance on the field. So as far as just the everyday exerciser, just, you know, active recovery, stretching, foam rolling, if you can get your hands on some massage therapy and combine all of those things, you'll have good response.
Very good. That's probably the best response you'll ever get. So whenever we have questions about DOMS, I'm going to say episode 127, 50 minutes in, something like
yeah.
that. And just a couple of quick housekeeping things that I wanted to get to is that I got some late-minute questions for the show, and one was from Peter, who John, Tony, and I met at the Winter Seminar. He goes to Mike Boyle's Winter Seminar every year, and he had a quick question about assessments with our personal training clients. And you know what? He references the functional movement screen, but guess what? It's coming up with Mike Boyle right after this. We talked about that for like 10 minutes, so You're going to get that question answered. I did not forget about it. And I think that's going to be it for us, folks. Do you guys feel like we finished this one off?
That was pretty good. That was like the fastest FitCast we've done in a long time.
Well, yeah, we had like a two and a half hour FitCast last week, so yeah. I think...
It ended up being that long?
Oof. Yeah, it was like 2:20, I think.
Oh.
Yeah, I think we really need to get some lives.
Speak for yourself, John.
Stop sitting on the FitCast forever.
You know, it's...
I wonder how many people actually listen to it, like, start to finish without stopping.
Oof.
There's a lot.
A lot. They just throw it on in the car and go to work and stuff like that. So, I think that's it. And we're just going to say thanks for listening. Don't forget to check out Tony Gentilcore's website at the Boston Herald Step Up blog, where... Tony, what are you going to be writing about this week? Is it still going to be off the cuff? You don't know yet?
Yeah, no, I have a general idea. I'm probably going to do a miscellany one, and I have a couple that I have on tap this week. So I've been updating a little bit more often lately, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. Look forward to that. And also, Jonathan Fast might blog at jonathanfast.blogspot.com. It's been about 3 weeks, so that would be about right.
I'm going to blog about DOMS. Pink Dumbbell Award to the...
Hold on. Dude, if you're going to do that, you got to let me play the music.
Well, if I don't do that, I'm going to get yelled at.
All right, can you just talk about something else for a second?
You know, I think we need to come up with a Knowledge Bomb Award, because that was a Knowledge Bomb again, John.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. So, I hate physiology, too. So.
Really?
Yeah, I hate physiology.
Could have fooled me.
Biochem and all that crap, I hate it.
Is that good for a knowledge bomb?
I thought that was just you breathing into the
mic. I thought you were having a moment. You know? How about the Terminator 2 when she's like stuck on a fence? You know, and like it's the explosion happens, like it's because that's how vicious the knowledge is.
What?
It's Sarah Connor's.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I do know what you're talking about too. Was that when like the truck exploded or something?
You know, she's.
Oh, she's looking at the park. The swing is swinging, and then the overlap of the city, the bomb goes off.
Yeah, she's like.
Yeah.
And then she gets fried.
One. That was a good one.
Knowledge bomb. That is what I see in my head when I hear you talk, John.
Oh, I see puppies.
Just kidding.
You see Sarah Connor getting fried to
right
your bones.
I don't know if I can find that. Like, all I can find is...
I don't know if I can find that. What would you Google?
I turned it into a soundboard.
You know what's funny about memory, too, is now when I picture that scene, I'm picturing the actress from this TV series.
Oh, you're, like, transferring it?
Yeah, yeah.
You're seeing Lena Headley?
Yeah, I'm not actually seeing the original actress.
I love Lena anyway. She's hot.
Yeah, she is. 300.
Oh, no. Okay. Actually, you know what? Terminator is a fantastic TV show, and it's going to get canceled, which sucks. I watch that every week. But the day after.
Bad?
What's that?
Is it doing bad?
Doing really bad since they moved it to Friday.
Fox thinks it's doing bad. I hear Dollhouse is doing bad too.
Yeah, it's doing really
bad. Is it really? I've been watching Dollhouse and I've been kind of getting into it.
Summer Glau, man, as a female Terminator, not bad. She does a pretty good job. So, anyways, we were closing the show out, and John, I think you were going to talk about this.
To the Red Bull and vodka question, because then we then we found out how stupid Tony is by mixing Red Bull with or whatever the hell he mixed with his protein shake, which is just
spike in metabolic drive.
Yeah, that was a fail. That
not coming to you from Biotest anytime soon.
Right. So that may have been actually the fail of the week too, because that's a bad
The fail of the week? No, the fail of the week is realizing that Kevin's never watched Pulp Fiction.
That's true.
Oh, yeah.
But that wasn't even part. Was that part of the off topic? Or
yeah.
Did we cut that?
Yeah.
I don't even think it was on the off topic.
I don't think
so. We were past that point.
Yeah, we were past it. So, ladies and gentlemen, Kevin Larrabee has never seen Pulp Fiction.
After the nuclear war.
Okay. Fine, I'll take it. You know, I'll take it like a man, and I will watch Pulp Fiction tonight.
Nice.
I can do that. I can do that for you guys because that's how much it means to me. Let's see. John, acceleratedstrength.com, and Lee Peel is at avidityfitness.net and flzine.com. So that's it, folks. We're going to head out of here. I'm going to do some grocery shopping, and Tony's going to go ice up those calves. Right, Tony?
Tomorrow, yeah.
Because they're smoking hot.
Oh.
Take care, everyone. See you next week.
Michael Boyle, strengthcoach.com, the number one source of performance enhancement information on the internet. Are you looking for cutting-edge information updated almost every day? Do you like info-packed forums with almost real-time answers from industry experts? Then log on to www.strengthcoach.com. For only $1 for 14 days, you can test drive the number one source of performance enhancement information on the internet, strengthcoach.com. Have you logged on today?
With me right now is Mike Boyle. You probably know him from his many articles on TNation.com. And, I mean, he's been sponsoring our show for the last couple of weeks or last couple of months. And now you should be checking out StrengthCoach.com. We've talked about it a lot on the show in the past. And it's one of the resources that I use, especially as a new trainer, new to the fitness world, really. Now getting my feet wet finally in the public. And everyone should be going there, especially I think one of the best parts about it is the forum, but Mike also has articles up there every single week, usually a couple times a week. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Well, it seems like we just talked yesterday because we were just at the your winter seminar this, I think, just 3 weeks ago, 3 or 4 weeks ago. How did that go overall? How do you feel about how the seminar went?
I think it went great. You know, it's funny when you look at the quality of speakers. It's scary, actually, that you could get, you know, kind of in a local seminar, the level of information, of knowledge that you got at that seminar. I thought everybody who did a presentation was really outstanding. You know, they were like, it was one after another. I love it when I can sit there and just kind of be an attendee and listen to these guys go. So it was, I mean, you were there. It was very, very good.
Yeah, and I think one of the best, or probably not one of the best way to describe it, but the most surprising and interesting presentation was Chris Nowitzki talking about concussions, and that was something that was never brought to my attention. And I thought that was easily one of the most interesting and, you know, in some cases, one of the most disturbing presentations I've ever seen.
No question. That was why I did it. He came in and spoke to our staff a couple months ago. And right when he did it, I was like, I have to add this to the seminar. And I sent out an email to the guys, you know, to Mike and Eric and Brajesh and John, and said, hey, you know, everybody's time's getting cut by 10 minutes because, you know, I got to squeeze this in. You know, this is way, way, way too compelling to leave out. And actually, either next week or the week after, I'm actually going to have concussion week. One of the things I've been doing with strengthcoach.com is sort of trying to theme week stuff so that we have some, some rhyme or reason. Not that it matters, but I think it just makes it a little bit more interesting when, you know, each week can kind of have a little different emphasis. This week is combine training week, and I've actually got two good, really PowerPoint presentations, but one is by Chris and one is by another guy, you know, that relate to concussions, and I think that's an area where we need a lot more education. So I'm going to dedicate, you know, at least two out of the three articles will be concussion related either this week or next week.
Absolutely. And I found that it was very relevant, especially in Boston. We just had one of our beloved Celtics, Brian Scalabrine, just run into his own battle with concussions. He's looks like he's run into two concussions in the past 4 weeks or so, and they've had to actually sideline him for a month. And I'm a big Scalabrine fan. He gives hope to all of our redhead friends out there who can want to get into the NBA. So we got to give huge props to Brian Scalabrine.
Oh, no question. I mean, if you look at Patrice Bergeron, you know, they really, I mean, this is the type of thing when you saw, I mean, that's why I made him play that video in the end of, and I can't think, I thought it was, in fact, Andre Waters, but it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, of the ex-NFL guy, I mean, he couldn't recite the months of the year. You know, I mean, that is, it's frightening. I mean, it's beyond frightening to realize what, you know, when you look at some of these guys like Troy Polamalu and some of these guys who are making light of, you know, hey, it's a contact sport and you got to be able to hit with your head. And then you realize that guys like, guys like Justin Strelzik are dead and Terry Long is dead and, you know, the Benoit the wrestler is dead. I mean, these are guys who, you know, took their own lives out of desperation because they had lost their mental faculties. You know, that's not a joke. And I think initially, very much my response to the thought of the initial presentation was, you know, what's the big deal? You know, you get your bell rung. I played high school football. I played 1 year of college. And you get whacked in the head. It's, you know, it's part of the game. You know, you see stars, whatever, you know, whatever the term you want to use is, and, you know, maybe you have a headache the next day. And you really, we've minimized it to the point now where we're, you know, there's a very, I mean, it's not even a casual relationship. But I think that it's pretty factual that these guys are suffering brain damage. You know, and Chris made a great point. He said if you called a concussion a traumatic brain injury instead of a concussion, a lot more parents would take note, because I can give you a perfect example. We have people now, I can't tell you how many high school kids have a spondylolisthesis, you know, which is basically a forward slippage of their, you know, L5 vertebrae. And occasionally they get what they call a Scotty dog fracture, you know, a little fracture in the body of the vertebrae.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to someone who understands, that's not a life-threatening situation. When a parent hears fractured vertebrae, they freak. Absolutely freak. I can't tell you how many parents I've had. Do you realize he broke his back? You know, he fractured his spine. And I'm like, well, yeah, but not really. You know, but when you sort of contextualize things, hey, it is a fracture in the spine. You know, and that should that scare a parent? Absolutely. Even though we might look at it and think, oh, that's not really that big a deal. You know, there's no danger of the spinal cord. There's no structural damage. And it's the same thing with concussion. You think, oh, concussion, no big deal. Then you say traumatic brain injury, and you're like, well, wait a second, my kid had a traumatic brain injury? You know, I thought you said he had concussion. And it's like, well, that's what a concussion is. It's a traumatic brain injury. You know, and too many traumatic brain injuries can leave you incapacitated as a result. So, you know, it's pretty scary.
Well, it's and if people want to check out a little bit of Chris's stuff, and just go to chrisnowitzki.com, and I'll make sure to link to that in the show notes. We talked about it on the FitCast.
I think it's also sportslegacyinstitute.com, I think.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, that's the nonprofit organization that Chris is running right now.
Yeah. But of course, we have some actual training questions too, don't we? I could be sitting here yapping about concussions all day, and people will think we're all crazy.
Yeah, we got a couple of them. What's go to the first one from Catherine. She says, hi, Kevin. I really enjoy the podcast, but I must admit I'm a few episodes behind. I'll have to listen to episode 126 soon. The stuff on low back injuries is always good to review. My question for Mike is fairly simple. I am trying to figure out the difference between split squat exercises and lunges. To me, they look basically the same. Is there any difference with regard to form and muscles trained? Thanks for the info.
Well, we'll go shameless plug first, because I wrote a really good article. Actually, I wrote the article, I think it's in Alan Cosgrove's Lift Strong packet, if they have that, and it's called Single Leg Knee Dominant Exercise, New Look at an Old Idea. It's also on strengthcoach.com under the same title. And so for $1, you can read the whole article. And then maybe continue to be a member. But basically, to break it down, they're entirely different. I always say, because people even call split squat stationary lunges, and I said stationary lunges is like jumbo shrimp. You can't stationary and lunge. You know, they don't go together. So in a split squat, I would say a split squat is what we would classify. You know, we tried to break these down and say, okay, how do we categorize these exercises? So we said it's a static single leg supported exercise. Static meaning not moving in the sense that the feet are not moving. The feet are static. They are placed in one place. It is a supported exercise in the sense that you have the support of the back foot to give you additional balance. It is a knee-dominant exercise in terms of, you know, if you want to classify things, obviously there's nothing that's knee-dominant that's not got a hip element to it, but knee-dominant to me are things that are more like squats. So that's what a split squat is. A lunge, on the other hand, is a dynamic single leg supported knee-dominant exercise. They're very, very different. And the other thing that we classified as, the, you know, like, a lunge is a decelerative exercise. One of the reasons that I've not been a huge fan of the whole sort of multi-planar lunge thought process that's been out there to some degree is because all lunges are by nature decelerative. They are braking actions.
Mm-hmm.
You decelerate, you back to center. That's a good, it's a very essential skill, but it is not enough to train. You know what I mean? You've got to do some accelerative exercises. I would look at a walking lunge would be an accelerative exercise, but a walking lunge is really a hip-dominant exercise. And the analogy that I've been using in my Perform Better presentations this year is it's like horses and zebras. They look a lot alike, but they're not really related. You know? You know what I mean? When they look at the DNA, it's like, you know, a zebra really isn't in the horse family.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way, a lunge really isn't in the split squat family, and a walking lunge is not really in the lunge family. You know, and people would look at all this stuff and say, oh, you know, it's all the same. It's really not. A lunge is a posterior chain, hip-dominant exercise. A walking lunge, posterior chain, hip-dominant exercise. A conventional lunge is very much an anterior chain, knee-dominant exercise, working primarily on deceleration. A split squat is a static, stationary exercise, still knee-dominant, but I guess you could say it's probably neither, you know, primarily accelerated or decelerated. So how's that for a long answer to a short question? I'll probably have her more confused as opposed to less.
Well, now she can just check out the article, you know, if
exactly.
she needs
to know. That'd
be perfect. Let's go to the next question that is a little out of order, but since it's very similar to this question, it's in the kind of the same family. Mike, you emphasize single leg training. How do you transition an untrained individual to doing single leg work?
You know, it's funny. You're right. It does. It actually segues perfectly in the sense that it's basically, if you look at the idea of split squats, I mean, that's how we do it. We begin split squatting, and I think you can split squat and then theoretically, if you had some, well, let's go back a step. I think before somebody begins single leg training, you need to come up with some sort of parameter for double leg training. What we basically did is said, okay, if we get a really weak, let's say, you know, you're starting somebody at, you know, Boston Sports Club who's a beginner's beginner, you know, a housewife or an office worker, and, you know, has never done anything where they bend their knees.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see them be able to do 20 body weight sumo deadlifts or sumo deadlifts with a kettlebell, like a 20-kilo kettlebell. When they can do 20 sumo deadlifts with a kettlebell, so the kettlebell between the knees, because I like that in the sense that it's sort of a squat that looks like a deadlift or a deadlift that looks like a squat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, knees wide. You know, you get a lot of, you know, upper back thoracic extension kind of element to it. You give them a reasonable depth gauge because they've got to be able to touch the kettlebell to the floor in a squatting pattern like you would if you were a conventional sumo deadlifter. Once they can do that, then they're probably ready for body weight single leg training. And then it's really a matter of just putting them in that split squat stance. I think in the worst case scenario, you could put them in a deloaded split squat stance. The way to put them in a deloaded split squat stance is to simply give them like a lat pull down bar
mm-hmm.
to hold on to with a small amount of weight on it, you know, with the whatever amount of weight is required to get them through that motion. And then basically have them work. The one thing you've got to realize in this, I was at a rehab seminar that Kevin Wilk did, and it was kind of an interesting thought process. He said that in the initial couple sets, 60% failure is okay. So if 6 out of 10 reps don't look that great, that's all right in the beginning with body weight training, because there will be a big proprioceptive element to people trying to learn to split squat. You know, there'll be a, you know, learning to be in that split position and to get themselves up and down and learning to, you know, control their trunk and can control their, you know, their backside hip. But that's really how we're going to transition them into that. And our idea, you know, if you read, and it's not like I'm plugging all my products here, but in functional training for sports, one of the things that we talked about was what we call a bodyweight progression. And a bodyweight progression was basically the idea of doing three sets of eight with each leg, three sets of 10 with each leg, three sets of 12 with each leg. Once you get to three sets of 12 with each leg, you can either move to a more difficult exercise or you can begin to load that exercise beyond body weight. Depending on the person, we may place the load in one of three or four areas. If someone really has trouble keeping their hip in extension in the split squat, we're going to give them a body bar, but we're going to ask them to actually put it behind them under their gluteal fold.
Okay.
To sort of push their bottom hip forward. If someone has trouble maintaining lumbar extension, we're going to put the body bar behind them and ask them to basically hook it with their elbows so that it becomes a stimulus for lumbar extension.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody has trouble with thoracic extension, we may put them in a back squat position with a light body bar. And if someone really struggles, we may put them in an overhead split squat position with the bar actually held overhead if they really are struggling with all of the extension, but they've got the capacity to do that. So, you know, we're talking, that's the beauty of the whole body bar system is, you know, in a lot of places you've got 6, 9, 12, 15, you know, we've got a whole collection of body bars going up by 3-pound increments, and it really does make things very simple for adding low amounts of resistance to somebody in a split squat. Probably the last place I'm going to put resistance in the beginning for beginners in their hands, because I think in their hands we're going to lose some of the posture that we're trying to gain, you know, as it pulls them forward.
Gotcha. The next question comes from Craig from Stone Mountain, Georgia. He asks, Mike, I've enjoyed your talks at Perform Better seminars several times. You were the first to introduce me to foam rolling. My 3-day-a-week strength workout is fairly intense, very little rest between exercises, and lasts 30 to 35 minutes, not counting rolling prior to and stretching afterwards. I finish off with a 4-minute Tabata routine with a band attached to the wall in my waist using various lateral and forward sprint patterns. This really helps my movement on the tennis court. My pulse maxes out around 170, and I'm 52 years old. My question is, I cool down on the Airdyne immediately after the Tabatas. It would be very easy for me to maintain a relatively high pulse at 150 with very little effort because I'm tired from the workout. Is there value to steady energy system development at the end of a workout when you're exhausted and it's easy to maintain a high pulse just using a steady pace? And if so, how long would it be beneficial?
I guess the question is, you know, I always go back, I think we talked about this last time in terms of goals. If this guy's not overweight and doesn't need extra steady-state cardio, and he said, is there value in doing extra steady-state cardio at the end of the workout, I'd give him a big, unequivocal no. No, there's no value. Don't bother. You know, go back, you know, cool down for a couple minutes if that's what you want to do, and then go on about your business. If the person is overweight and would like to do some additional calorie burning, it's actually a really good time because, as you said, you don't need a lot of intensity to maintain a relatively high heart rate. So that's a good time to throw in an extra 15 or 20 minutes. So I guess depending on where he is, you know, sort of not, you know, because, I mean, on the fitness scale, if he's 52, he's getting his heart rate to 172, and he's doing running, resisted running Tabatas, I don't think fitness is an issue for this guy. And, you know, if he's not overweight, I would say no.
Well, there you go, Craig. And, you know, I think that's... You know, I think it's worth bringing up that I think you mentioned just at this past winter seminar that the Airdyne is your piece of equipment of choice for your athletes when they're doing their intervals or their Tabatas. Do you mind just telling the audience why that is?
Yeah, I mean, well, the Airdyne to me is the ultimate interval training machine, and I have I have a lot of notes. One of my notes is to try to find somebody at Nautilus because Nautilus actually owns Schwinn now. Mm-hmm. Or at least owns the Airdyne. I don't know if they own the bike part of Schwinn, but they own the Airdyne. And I think it's the most underutilized piece in the fitness field. I don't think there's a better piece for interval training. The thing that is completely unique about the Airdyne is it's direct accommodating resistance. The harder you work, the more resistance you get. You don't have to touch a button. You don't have to turn a knob. In every other piece of equipment that you deal with, to change your resistance, you need to do something. So especially in things like Tabatas where you're trying to do 20 on, 10 off, I mean, it can get really difficult to sort, you know, towards the sixth one to be thinking about, okay, I got to press the button to get back down, and then, okay, you know, you're thinking, oh, then it's 9, 7, 8, press the button to get back up. I mean, it's almost, I would say, almost impossible to do it on one of these bikes that involves turning knobs or pressing buttons and really stay to the protocol. We do them with our hockey guys, and, I mean, you get no excuse. All you got to do is, like, go harder, go easier, go harder, go easier, you know, and the bike accommodates because of the, you know, the way the fan is built in those Airdynes. The harder you push the pedals, the more wind resistance you generate. So, I mean, they're to me, I don't even think there's anything close. Kaiser, you know, likes, I think it's their M5 bike, which is probably the closest thing. But the one thing the Kaiser bike misses is the upper body action. The heart rates are extremely high on the Airdyne because you've got all four limbs moving.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, is unique in the cardiovascular. Well, some people say, well, you can move everything on the elliptical, but I'm like, yeah, you know, try to get your heart rate up to 170 beats and then on the elliptical.
Well, it's kind of sad
because
that
the Airdyne, you can push and pull. Go ahead, sorry.
We're probably never going to see those on commercial gyms because I don't think you can affix an LCD TV screen to it.
Exactly. You know, they're too hard. The one thing I thought about, I really think that you could have, you know, like spinterval classes or something like that, you know? Spinning interval classes using the Airdyne, you know, because they're cheaper than spin bikes to buy, and they're better. They're more effective. The body position is better. The heart rate is higher. Someone, if you're listening, I'm going to sue you if you steal my idea. So I'm a listener out there. But I really believe that there's something there that a lot of people are missing from the standpoint of interval training on the Airdyne. With our hockey guys, it's one of the primary tools we use in preseason.
The next question comes from Brian. He says, I'm a 47-year-old male, 5'10", 180 pounds, pretty solid build. I've been focusing on pull-ups for the last few months and have built up to 4 sets of 15 to 17 each set every morning. I'm loving them. I've changed my grip. I change my grip every set, palms in, palms out, wide grip, narrow grip, etc. Lately, however, I've developed a pain in one elbow. The injury seemed to start in the joint, like tennis elbow, but now seems as much in the forearm muscle near the joint as in the joint itself. It seems like a tendon strain to me, but my joint, quote, cracks, like cracking a knuckle every so often while under strain. I'm not a fan of taking a bunch of medicine and don't want to start in on a bunch of anti-inflammatories. I'm not too excited about a cortisone shot either. I'd hate to stop doing pull-ups since they're doing good things for me, plus they're so convenient. Is there anything else I can do to keep up with my pull-ups without the joint, tendon, muscle pain? I'd appreciate any advice. Thanks, and keep up the good work.
You know, that was the one I read. Now, you know, I said, that's like the kid who tells you, you know, I really like ice cream, and now I eat it every day, 3 times a day, and I'm sick.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, you like pull-ups. Everybody knows that you probably need to stimulate a muscle at most twice a week to get the benefit. I mean, that's a simple case of overuse. If you just cut down, so if he'd just been doing it twice a week like he was supposed to, he'd be fine now. The problem now is he has given himself a good case of tendonitis, and you can call it, you know, whatever, you know, golfer's elbow, little league elbow, you know, epicondylitis humeri. You know, you get an inflammation along the epicondyle where the muscles insert. Now he's got that moving over, passing into the muscle itself away from the actual condyle or epicondyle. And, you know, it's just starting to get worse, probably because his initial approach probably was the ignore method. Mm-hmm. I'll ignore this and it'll go away. But if you continue to do pull-ups every day for sets of 12 to 17, I'm going to tell you that more than likely it's not going away. So, you know, the number one thing, you know, again, I don't want to take a bunch of anti-inflammatories, and I don't want a cortisone shot. Well, one, take the anti-inflammatories before you think about a cortisone shot. Two, start to do some soft tissue work on yourself in that spot. So spend, you know, 2 or 3, 4 or 5 minutes every day finding those sore spots and trying to work them out in that spot. I would probably recommend going to strictly pull-ups so you get more biceps and more brachialis and get kind of away from that. You know, the parallel grip or the chin-up grip is going to clearly give you more wrist flexor pull, which is probably going to magnify that problem a little bit. But the big thing is I try to cut it down to 2 days a week and, you know, start treating the injury as opposed to thinking of reasons why you don't. You know, he made a very good list of why he didn't want to take care of the injury as opposed to making a very good list of, how he would. You know, I'm thinking, you know, has he iced? Does he ice massage his elbow? Does he massage his elbow? Has he been stretching his forearm flexors? Has he, you know, has he cut down on the volume of chin-ups that he's been doing? My guess, kind of knowing the obsessive nature of people that weight train, is none of the above.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he just keeps going down there and training, and it's one of those, you know, tomorrow I'll wake up and it'll be gone. You know, and tomorrow you wake up and you're like, oh, it's not gone. Okay. Now what do I do? Okay, I'll go do some pull-ups. No, you know, I mean, and you know, I mean, I've been, my shoulder's been sore for 4 months. And I would say for 2 months, I completely ignored it, thinking it was just going to go away. Now, the last 2 months, I've been really aggressively rehabbing it, and I'm very, very slowly getting back to, you know, to my shoulder feeling better. But I think it's human nature to think, you know, all right, you know, I'll close my eyes, and when I open them, everything will be gone. No, it's not going to work that way. So I guess my recommendation to him would be get a proactive approach going here. Start figuring out, treat the injury.
Well, I had kind of a similar issue, and I actually went to see John Powell for it because I, every time I would bench, there would be excruciating pain in my left forearm. And one of the best things that I could do to work that out was, Brian, if you can go get this thing called a stick. They have them out Perform Better, and I just lodge that up in against like a doorway or a power rack and just do my soft tissue work on my forearm with that, and it's worked perfect.
Yeah, you can even do, you know, we'll sometimes with forearms, we'll take the smaller, the hard foam massage balls that Perform Better sells and put them against a wall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you can rub. And that's, I mean, there's always ways, you know, lacrosse balls, there's all kinds of stuff you can use. But fingers work great, too.
Yeah.
You know, just get in there and dig it out. I mean, the beautiful thing about soft tissue work is it's very simple. Find where it hurts and then press on that spot. You know, it's also very counterintuitive. You know, the idea is, you know, I'm going to find this spot that's really sore, then I'm going to press it.
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense, but it does. You know, you need, because what you're doing, you know, I wrote an article of my 5 aha moments, and one of the things that I was very surprised about was that there is an actual biochemical reaction that occurs from irritating the tissue that is beneficial. I didn't know that. I used to always think, well, you know, there's a relaxation response. You know, whatever you're doing, it's causing the tissue to relax. But it's really more complex than that. When you irritate the tissue, you promote the output of beneficial material that's going to cause healing. And so the idea, you know, a lot of times when you do soft tissue work on yourself, you should be more sore the next day to the touch but less sore to move, because you've actually irritated the tissue. But that irritation, that produces healing as opposed to more problems. Another thing to look at, sorry, and I'm digressing. You should probably look at just some simple side-lying external rotation stuff. I think sometimes what I found with some people is that their internal rotation lats are really strong, and as a result they can do chin-ups, yet when you ask them to do simple external rotation stuff, they're very, very weak. And it's like when your external rotators are weak, I think your forearm flexors really overwork. So I think one of the big cures for a lot of the, you know, tennis elbow, golfer's elbow, stuff like that tends to lie in some really simple rotator cuff training stuff.
The last question that we have from Sam, how do you assess your new clients, be it a high school athlete or an office worker? That's a pretty broad question, but...
Well, high school athletes, we really don't assess, in all honesty. You know, like, we won't do a functional movement screen with the average kid that comes into our program. With our, you know, our office worker, our personal training client, we're going to do a functional movement screen with our personal training client, because we know with that client, we're going to get 2 to 3 hours a week to improve that client, and I think we've got to be very focal.
Mm-hmm.
With our athletic clients, we're going to get 4 to 6 hours a week, and... You know, we know that they're all going to foam roll, they're all going to stretch it. You know, they're all going to do everything they need to do to get better, so that, you know, the need to evaluate is probably less. And for most kids, you know, you don't see as much adaptive change in a 14, 15, 16-year-old kid as you do in a 30 or 40-year-old, although we are seeing more, you know, postural things from these kids being seated so long. But the other thing is, time-wise, you know, from a business standpoint, it's not real effective to spend... You know, if you've got 100 kids, you could spend the first week of the 10-week program just evaluating them and the second week just figuring out what you're going to do. Whereas, you know, I've always been a big believer in the idea that one of the most corrective things in the world is exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And if you choose your exercises well, So, you know, if we've got everybody who's going to do, you know, glute work and scap work and posterior shoulder work and posterior chain work, you know, if we get them working out, we're going to get a lot of people better. But with our personal training clients, we will spend a little bit more time on that. FMS. Everyone should go to that course. I mean, hey, if you're in this business and you haven't been to a functional movement screen class yet, go. It will change not only the way that you think, it'll change the way you think, it'll change the way you train, and it will change the way your clients look at you. Your clients will think you're smarter when you understand the functional movement screen. Maybe that's because you're smarter.
Well, I mean, worst case, you can always just go to the website and you pick up the DVDs if you really can't make it to any of the seminars out there. But
yeah, and you used to be able to. I don't know if you still can. You actually can watch all the videos of how to do it right on their site, or at least you could. I haven't been on their site in a while. But at functionalmovement.com, they have all the tests and all the scoring procedures right on the site. So theoretically, you could give yourself a functional movement screen class, I think, by going onto the website.
I'll make sure to link to that as well in the show notes so people can check that out. The very last question, Mike, like what's been going on at strengthcoach.com? The forums are always busy. What can we look for in the near future at strengthcoach.com as well?
Oh, lots of good stuff. I mean, more videos, more programs, more articles. I mean, we just keep trying to get, you know, initially we started out with the idea we were going to have three articles a week, and now we've gone to three articles a week plus a video. And we're trying to get, I've been trying to get a program up every week, which I don't always do because I've been learning to use Jing. So that one of the things we realized, you know, we were having a hard time posting Excel files.
Mm-hmm.
And then we realized we can screen capture them and they go in as pictures. So it's very easy now to post Excel programs because it's basically the same as posting a photo. And so that will allow us to post more programs. So I'm hoping we can get more programs and continue to get more and more, you know, good quality video stuff. The good thing about it is it's really catching on. So I get more and more stuff sent to me, more and more submissions of just great stuff that, you know, I'm actually backlogged. I'm probably, I would say, realistically, I've got at least a month backlog of stuff and maybe more. You know, I haven't actually stopped and counted the number of articles. And then what happens is I get timely ones, like we're running one that Jim Reeves wrote about anterior core training. He wrote it in response to a forum post from last week, so I jumped out ahead of some other ones. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I have some people I feel bad because they've sent me really good stuff and I haven't used it.
Well, people, if you haven't, like Mike said, you get a trial at strengthcoach.com for $1. It's a dollar. That's less than a bottle of water these days. And if you give it a shot, I'm positive that you're going to love it. And just like I think we talked about this before, but Mike, I'm always, every morning there's blogs that I check out. I go to the strengthcoach.com forum. I go to the you have an advanced and a beginner's forum, and I go to both. I see what people are talking about. Look at usually your answers are always seem to be the first immediate response, which I think is, you know, quite amazing that you can get such a quick response for a lot of these people on the forum. And it's just been a great tool, just as, you know, for people out there who want to either, I don't care if you want to be a strength coach or not, I deal with everyday people. I deal with office workers. That's predominantly all my clients are looking for fat loss, and I've been able to use tons of stuff from strengthcoach.com, especially just looking at things like rehab, things like mobility. So it's definitely worth checking out. And
yeah, I think there's no question people will, I think if you're serious about the industry, you'll be a fan right away. And that's what we're seeing. I think we've got a, you know, we don't have a huge membership base because it's basically people who are real serious.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a casual site. It's not like, you know, go on and goof around. There's not a lot of bullshit. There's not a lot of typical internet, you know, banter going on there. It's a very serious, I mean, it's good. It's supportive. There's, I mean, you like said, you know, my answers, but I look at some of the answers sometimes and I'm like, you know, Charlie Weingroff and Jim Reeves and, you know, some of these guys that just go on and throw stuff up and really detailed stuff that, you know, I'm looking like, I look at, you know, some people, whenever anybody cancels, I'm like, $10 a month, you're not into this. you know, you're, you know what I mean? That's why I don't, I used to get offended, but I realized the casual lurker might be like, ah, whatever. You know, it's over my head, I don't understand it. But the serious person, if you're serious about personal training or fitness or strength and conditioning, I mean, the amount of information, a guy threw up a question about external rotation stuff yesterday, and I looked at the answers, and I just wrote that at the end. I said, I bet you didn't expect to get that, did you? Because it was unbelievably great. I sat and read it, and I'm like, wow, I cannot believe these guys went to this length to explain to him. He was like, I was at a football conference, and someone talked about working external rotators versus internal rotators. And, you know, he got probably 10 paragraphs of incredibly detailed information within, you know, I would say within 8 hours of asking the question. That's crazy when you think you can get stuff that quick.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the way people can rationalize it, if you really need a rationalization for it, you know, that's 2 cups of coffee per month that you wouldn't have at Starbucks. It's really not that much of money for a ton of information. So,
well, the one thing like Alan Cosgrove always talks about, hey, if that gets you one client, the average trainer's making, you know, whatever, $25, $35, $45, $55 an hour. If for $10 a month,
I know,
you're going to get information that might get somebody to sign up for another $1,000 worth of training, that's a pretty good return on your investment. If I could spend $10 and make $1,000, I'd be doing that every day.
Well, that brings me to my next point. You are also going to be presenting at Perform Better's upcoming seminar in Boston, Massachusetts, along with Gray Cook, Alan Cosgrove, and Todd Durkin. What are you going to be speaking about there for people who might be still on the fence about signing up?
Basically, we're going to talk about fat loss and low back pain. So training clients that are obese and training clients with low back pain. Because one of the things I've been trying to do more and more with the Perform Better stuff is gear my talks toward, like you were saying, you know, although your interest and your passion might be strength and conditioning, right now what you're doing primarily is adult fitness. I think that's 90% of trainers out there. I think 10% of the people are dealing with athletes, dealing with general population. And if there's two things in the general population that are of huge interest, fat loss and low back pain. So that's where I'm going. That's where I'm going this year.
Perfect. And that's going to be on March 21st and the 22nd. Those are both one-day seminars from Perform Better. And again, we're talking about a good long day. We're talking about from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. for $150. First is the 4 presentations, and there's the Learn by Doing, where I think that's probably the more important part, is that hands-on stuff. I cannot, you know, I always talk about on the show how I learned so much from my internship at Cressy's just by getting that hands-on stuff. You can read all the books in the world, but once you actually start dealing with clients, that's when you really need everything to start connecting.
No question. And like I said, that's a great situation because we do the same seminar 2 days in a row. The Boston one has gotten so big that it's we do it Saturday, and then it's like Groundhog Day. We do the same seminar again on Sunday. So if somebody could, you can go either day, or you can even, you know, what some of my staff do because they're working Saturday morning, is they split it up. They go to the practicals on Saturday afternoon, and they come back Sunday morning and listen to the lectures. So that might be a tip for guest listeners if they're thinking, oh, I'm not going to be able to get there, or I don't want to spend my whole Sunday there.
As long as there's not another snowstorm.
You can sign up for Saturday. Sign up for Saturday. Go Saturday afternoon and listen to the practicals. Go Sunday and listen to the lectures if you know you're in a situation where you can't get the full day.
And just pray for no snow. I know Alan Cosgrove will be pissed if it snows again. Well, that will wrap it up, Mike. Again, everyone, please make sure to check out strengthcoach.com. Mike, huge pleasure to always have you on. Hope to have you on again sometime in the future.
Thank you very much. I look forward to it.
Thank you. Okay, we're here in the off-topic discussion. First thing on the docket is Tony Gentilcore and I are going to briefly talk about Watchmen and our impressions. We didn't really talk that much after the movie.
No, because it was just kind of awkward watching a movie with so much Wang in it.
just kind of like went our separate ways.
And it's not only that, but the, you know, I don't go to movies that much anymore. And there was at one part, like, this isn't a spoiler or anything, but there's like a 7-minute sex scene. And watching that in IMAX with 500 people, and not to mention, like, Tony, you saw the dude next to me. He was a huge mouth breather and stuffing his face with popcorn. So the whole time during the sex scene, I heard. And I'm like, oh my God, get me out of here. But
all I remember is when we left, I forgot the chick's name. She's also in Heartbreak Kid with Ben Stiller. But Kevin's like, oh, that's the most perfect girl ever.
See, no, that's the woman I like. Like, that is good. She's
true.
She's
the mother?
No, the daughter.
No, the daughter.
The daughter's cute, but the mother, I forget her name. She's beautiful.
She's hot.
She's also like 70 years old for most of the movie, too.
Cougar, man. Cougar.
Yeah. Luckily, I've seen her without that makeup on, and she's very attractive.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard.
But I gave the movie a B minus.
Really?
I don't know why Tony did that, because it was everything I wanted from that movie. I knew nothing about the Watchmen comic books except a couple things that were...
Well, first of all, it's not a comic book.
Oh, so sorry. It's a graphic novel, Tony. Fuck you. No, I won't, because...
Hey, I'm not a comic book guy, but that's an insult to the people who read graphic novels. They'll tell you that it's not a comic book. I'm just saying. I'm on your side, dude.
These are the same people that hate Smallville because it's like an alternate take on Superman. Although I like Smallville. Good episode this week. But Tony gave it a B-, but if we're going to use the letters rating scale, I will give it a very solid B+, maybe even A-, because, again, it was
A-? Are you kidding me?
Tony, can I finish?
Sure, yes.
Then the whole point of going and spending $11 to go see an IMAX movie is I want something loud, I want something with a ton of action, I want there to be violence, and it was... Like, when you watch stuff that's especially VFX heavy, like, that's the reason why if a movie especially has tons of VFX, like, I'll buy it on Blu-ray just because, like, I want that extra definition. I want to just have the perfect experience when I go see that, and I don't want it to be, you know, reduced by watching the regular DVD or watching it on a non-HD TV or for the theater, just going to a regular crappy movie theater. Seeing it in IMAX gives it that bump into the B+, A-, and I thought it was nice to see a totally different take on the superhero movies. Like, after Spider-Man 3 and the Fantastic Four, like, those all sucked. And the last good superhero movie I saw was Iron Man, which was better than Batman 2.
You're insane.
The Dark Knight.
You're insane.
Much better movie. Because, again, I came to see a fun movie. I was very entertained. I smiled for a lot of the movie. Like, there was things that would happen, like with Rorschach, who I thought was the guy who did his character was outstanding. And
yeah, it was very good.
The whole time, I was just like, yes, I'm having so much fun at this movie. And... You know, I didn't really care that there was a huge blue thing in the middle of the screen, like, part of the time. Like, that's... Hopefully most people could get over that, although there was plenty of jokes made about that.
Dude, you sent me a text that you said you were happy about that.
I was, you know. It was proportional.
No, I enjoyed the movie. I'm not a B- isn't a bad score, and I thought Jackie Earle Haley was phenomenal as Rorschach. He was the best part of the movie, in my opinion.
Yeah, he was great.
But I don't know. I just thought it a little too long, in my opinion, and there were some dull.
Are you fucking serious? From a guy that basically, you know, whacks off to the Dark Knight.
I don't mind long movie. I thought the Dark Knight was long, but I still give that an A-. But I don't know. I just thought. I mean, I don't know. Just something was off. I mean, I like three. Like, the Zack Snyder also directed 300. I thought 300 was phenomenal, and this one just was a little off for me. Just a little bit.
All right, we're stopping this discussion. The
Lee, isn't it like listening to an old
and
married
I will,
couple?
I will say,
it really
Lee,
is.
Lee, Lee, like Kevin was, he was very good with his diet that day. He had his, 2 ounces of beef jerky and his 2 almonds. He was on point. So I will definitely back him up on that.
Yeah, I was packing heat. Tony brought like a jumbo bag of Trader Joe's beef jerky, and I had 2 separate individual plastic bags, one with maybe 2 or 3 pieces of beef jerky in it, and the other one with exactly 28 grams of almonds. So
yeah, you were like, even before when we were standing in line, you were like, that had to last you to what, 10?
Yeah, till 10:30.
Like oh, man. Give you credit, man.
Hey, it's working, and I'm still on it, and I haven't fallen off the bandwagon yet. Although, as I was talking to Lee beforehand, I really miss peanut butter a lot. But anything else you guys want to talk about and off topic? I don't know if there's Lee. What have you been up to?
It's beautiful out today. We did our me, Eric, and Anna went and did our sprints this morning.
Wow, we heard about that last week too.
I'm just saying. But last night it was cold. Today it was perfect though. Or last week it was cold. But thank you for making me feel like an asshole. I appreciate it.
Wow. I've been sick all week. Nice. So yeah, so I am I'm really high right now off of cough syrup medicine just to get through this. So that's where I'm at. If I say anything ludicrous, that's why. I'm blaming it on the cough syrup.
Hmm.
See, that bombed. And, you know, now there's quiet.
Kevin, it's all your fault.
Hold on to your butt.
I do have another soundboard this week. It's a new one, so it's gonna be better.
I'm excited.
Do you know who it is?
Does he look like a bitch?
Samuel Jackson. Pulp Fiction, man.
That guy is that's quite the actor. I like him a lot.
He's hit and miss.
Really?
Yeah. He's not hit and miss. He's the same all the time.
Except in Coach Carter.
The movies he does is just like. Eh.
Coach Carter was good.
Coach Carter sucked donkey dick.
Mm.
Wow.
Huh.
Wow, that's kind of guard, huh, John? You're like,
yeah,
I disagree.
Yeah, was that – no, I'm just wondering, was that like a direct quote from a review that you read, or was that your own work?
No, that was my own.
Okay. From the New York Times?
Yeah.
Suck donkey balls.
Roger Ebert, yeah. That's a good idea. I should write some movie reviews.
Yeah.
Instead of that would make a headline, like this movie sucked donkey dick, you think that would even make a headline somewhere?
I think that would be great. It would probably do it in the Boston Herald. I
True. Although, they've been known to censor me a little bit. I don't blame them, though.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I don't remember asking you a goddamn thing.
I won't use that during the show. I'm only going to use it during off topic.
Right. This is the part where no one listens to anyway, so.
Shut the fuck up!
There you go.
Are
you
these all Pulp Fiction quotes?
No, like this one is from Jurassic Park.
Hold on to your butt.
Remember, he's like gonna reboot the computer.
Oh, that's when he had like you know really small roles before he became big time.
Does he look like a bitch?
I've never seen Pulp Fiction, but I've seen that scene.
What?
What the hell, Kevin? You never seen Pulp Fiction?
What?
I know.
What the fuck?
Fail.
I know.
That
it's
fail.
Never. I don't have the DVD,
wow.
Man. I'll see it sometime. And I've seen the end part with John Travolta and the Samuel L. Jackson and the. When they're in the diner, but
that's
it.
A major.
Those are the only
fail.
Two parts I've seen.
Major. That's a life fail.
That's like the movie of the 90s.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry.
Jesus.
Well, we're going to wrap this up because we got quite a show with Mike Boyle interview at the end, too. Talked about quite a bit, so
cool.
We're gonna stop recording.